It's just good to be a man. I mean, it just is. God has done a good thing in making us men. I'd like you to open up your programs to the second page. And I said, there's something in this. This whole page, I think, begins to communicate our hearts in this matter. But I want to come down to the second paragraph, and I want to read that. This will help you see what's coming. Our challenge is to be men with conviction who are not passive, but committed to a cause higher than our own. Men who act responsibly, men who regard the welfare of those around them when those people need our leadership, and men who lay aside the temporal, short-lived rewards of a self-centered existence to embrace that life to the full promised by Jesus. This encapsulates our message over the next, I don't know how many hours it's going to be, 20 hours. And I realize, too, that in this room, I mean, we've got a group that's just all over the map as it relates to what was written right here. And we're all over the map as it relates to ages. We have some who are in their 80s, I believe. If not, you don't have to raise your hand, but there's some that are at least close. And we got some that are younger than 20. But I want to affirm that each one of you is a man, and these things apply. I also realize that in the sessions that we have coming up, some of the things that are said will mean different things to each one of you. Some of you are going to be instructed. I mean, you're going to be taught. Some of you are going to be encouraged. Some of you are going to be very, very challenged. Some of you are going to be reminded and encouraged in the reminder that what the road you've chosen to go down is a good road. You'll be reminded. I mean, and you need that. You need opportunity to have somebody to say, this is the right thing, and to reflect back and say, that's what I'm on. Thank you. That's the right thing. Some of you are going to be given tools with which to interact with other people. And this is something that's very much part of our heart for this time. We want to be able to talk a common language amongst ourselves about what manhood looks like, so that when we get with each other, we can talk to each other intelligibly. So if one of us, you know, somebody says, I'm really having a difficult time with my convictions. Well, we know what that means. When somebody says, I'm having a difficult time with some of the responsibilities that God's given me, I don't know what to do. We're talking the same language. When somebody says, you know, I just feel weak in my leadership, and I just need a jolt of courage, we know what they're talking about. And when somebody says, you know, the rewards that I'm seeking, I realize that you know, they're not the best, and I want help. You know, we're talking the same language. So some of this also reflects much of the counseling that Pastor Phil and I and Pastor Dave and Joe, as a college professor for over 30 years interacting with students, represents some of the things that we've heard and seen men struggle with. So we just want to come to you with these thoughts. And again, they're encapsulated right here. So the other thing, too, I just want to encourage you all. This is a fairly small group. We're fairly close together here. Don't hesitate to raise your hand. There's no reason why we can't be in a give and take as part of this. And you'll see some of us will actually do that. So if there's questions that, you know, something has been said that just gets you and, you know, I just don't agree with that. You know what? That's okay. Our desire here is to grow as men. Feel free. And I don't want to just open it up to just a free-for-all, but there may be some significant things that we need to just stop and talk about. So let's not shirk that. About 6 weeks ago, I put up a poster around the church. And on that church, or on that poster, there was some questions. And the first question was, what does it mean to be a man? I hope that sparked your curiosity. I hope you had some answers to that question. We as men should have some answers to that question. And hopefully they didn't just all rest on the genetic differences between a male and a female. We're actually different in more than just that. There were some other questions that were on that poster. Here are some of the questions. What are a man's responsibilities? What does a man believe? How does a man behave? What should a man try to achieve? These are questions that I think that we as a group of men need to wrestle over and come to some good, solid conclusions so that we can, again, we can sharpen each other and encourage each other in these. So can't lean on that like I do. So again, over the next 20 hours, we want to address these questions. If you come away from here without an answer to that, stop us, because we have answers we want you to come away with. We also want to do more than just answer the question now. We want to lay a framework for it so that we have something to spring off of for the next year. Our men's ministry is going to seek to try to address those questions and encourage men in the answers to those in a couple of different ways. The first is this advance. And then the second thing that we're going to be doing is monthly men's breakfast. We're going to be meeting from 7 to 9 on a monthly basis, one time a month, for breakfast. And then we're going to take time after breakfast to wrestle through in a little bit more depth and detail one of these areas that we talk about over the session. And then the other thing that we're going to do is we're going to try to get even smaller than just the men's breakfast, and we're gonna break you guys into much smaller groups. And as leaders, we're gonna try to get away with you in groups of, I don't know, 3 to 7, 8. I'm not exactly sure how that will all pan out, but we want to actually get away with you where we can talk in much greater depth and give each person time to really talk. I know for myself, I'm really looking forward to getting my boat fixed so I can take some men up in the islands and spend nights on the islands and just talk around a campfire about what it means to be a man. So, Joe, he wants to take men backpacking. You know, and just there's other ideas and thoughts about how to get men out of their normal routines and talk about these subjects. But I trust that after a year of doing this, we are very much on one page and very much walking down the same path and very much encouraged in what it means to be a man. So, let me just ask you the question. What is the difference between a boy and a girl? And I'm not talking about genetics in terms of just the physical differences, although they may help frame the question or frame the answer. But what are the differences between a boy and a girl? I mean a boy and a girl, not a man and a woman. But when you think about the differences between a boy and a girl, what are the differences between a boy and a girl? Somebody said emotion. I might actually say more emotionally sturdy. A boy just has a hardiness emotionally that many girls don't have. So, and somebody said cleanliness. I would attest to that with my sons. Okay, boys like to play in the mud and the trees, and they like to conquer. It's really different than tea parties. That's true. There's a natural aggressiveness. You just see. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. What else? Relational, okay. You know, when I think of the difference between boys and girls, I think testosterone. That's an amazing thing. I mean, our bodies are just coursing with this stuff. And when I was trying to answer this question for myself, an image came to my mind, and I don't want to embarrass John, but he is quite a young man, and I just this was so typical of a boy, of a man, and just this image. And this came last year. I think it was last year, as we were coming back from Susha Island on the back of Al Brown's boat. Al has a cabin cruiser, about a 24-foot cabin cruiser, and he's got a hard shell, and he's got rails on both sides. And he cruises, I don't know, about 23, 24 knots. And the waters, they weren't too rough, but, you know, we were bouncing along. And I was inside the cabin, with Al and a couple more because it was comfortable in there, frankly. But John and Josh, with their shirts off, were standing on the rail, hanging out over the boat for hours with the wind whipping through their hair and their teeth facing out. Is that the best you got? You know, just, and that's when I think of, when I think of the difference between boys and girls, I've never seen a girl do that. I just, thank goodness, yes. I asked the boys in Sean and Brad's Sunday school class, if there were no rules, what would you do? Yeah, who said boys are more dirty? Or who said that? Okay, that's true. One of them said they never shower. Another said they never wash their clothes. They thought that was cool. Another one, this was Oliver. He goes, man, I'd be jumping off 10-story buildings. This is cool. But, you know, again, there is a difference. What you see, and again, what comes to my mind is just that adventuresome, inquisitive, just testosterone-laden pursuit of life, where the world is open and I'm going to go get it. Now, what is the difference between a boy and a man? I know many men who just lost the boyish excitement for this world that God has given them. And they're just going with the flow. And to me, one of the saddest, I mean, everything that you all have said, I think is true. I mean, there's facets of all of that. But Joe mentioned, and maybe he mentioned it because we've been getting together and talking about this advance for weeks. So he has some sense of where I'm going. I want to address that place where so many boys see the world as theirs, and they're going to go grab it. And they're so full of optimism and hope. And then I see them later as men, and they've just simply lost it. And it's sad. And there is an element of harnessing that is important. There's an element of responsibility and perspective that's important. But so many men that I see, they're just passive. And it's really sad. And to me, I want to give them a charge and help them come out of that. I see many men and they remind me of a horse that I used to have. I used to look at that horse and just be sad. His name was Sundance Kid. We called him Sonny. He was a beautiful Arabian. And I don't know if you've ever seen an Arabian horse, but when you get them out prancing, What makes them different from a normal horse is their tail sits up high. So when an Arabian horse is excited, their head comes up and their tail comes up. And they prance. And they're beautiful to watch. And this horse of mine spent his days in a very small corral. And I would look out my back window at this horse, and his head would be down. And his tail would be down, and he would stand there for hours. And he was just passive. And I thought, that horse looks like so many men that I know. And it just made me sad. I mean, I just wanted to take that horse and open up the gate and say, just be free. It was always awkward for me to go ride him, because when I did open up that gate with me on it, he was so excited, I could hardly stay on it. I mean, you could just feel the vibrations going up in that horse's body. And he'd just start bouncing. He wouldn't walk. He would literally bounce out the gate, tail up, head up, and knee. And this horse bounces. And like I said, I would see that spirit come back, and he would bounce out the gate. And I see so many men where I just want to see that spirit come back, where they bounce out the gate. There are many people who have noticed this lethargy in men. There's a sociologist by the name of Stephen Clark who wrote this. This was his attempt to understand this passivity that he saw so much in men. He said, men have a natural tendency to avoid social responsibility. I remember the first time I read that, I thought, is that true? But his conclusion was that men, this is a condition of men. Men have a natural, which is inbred, a natural tendency to avoid social responsibility. That may be what it looks like, but I think he flat got it wrong. I don't think that's the right explanation. I think that the modern man is discouraged. I think he's disillusioned. And I think he's disconnected. I think the thrill has long gone. I think they've fought and they've won battles and they don't have any steam left. So I have another question for y'all. I just want you to think about this. If it looks like men have a natural tendency to avoid social responsibility, if that's what it really looks like, then what does our society expect of men? If the people of our society expect that men have a natural tendency to avoid responsibility, that they're naturally passive, then what does our society expect of men? Does our society expect men to be irresponsible? What do you see our society pushing towards men? What do you see? Actually stand on something, then we get criticized for it. I mean, to defend one's family against whatever, put you in a position to be, what? Too aggressive? Too strong? What else? What do you see our society pushing men towards? Yeah. It's interesting what I'm hearing. Do you all see words have meaning. And if you look things up in the dictionary, and you went back to old dictionaries and traced the development of our understanding of what words mean. You see things mean different things. But do you see the words passive and tolerant as interchangeable? Let me think about that for a minute. When I think of the word tolerant, as it's understood today, not as it was understood maybe 100 years ago, as one who abided other points of view, but didn't capitulate or give in on their own view. That was what tolerance always meant to me. Tolerance today means that you may not stand on anything, that anything that somebody might push forth as right, valid, and true is indeed right, valid, and true. And it's no less than what you might hold to. To me, that's what tolerance has become today. And passivity, when I think of somebody who's passive, it's just somebody who you push on and they just blow over. There's nothing standing. There's nothing solid. So if I have something that's true and this is true, I can push on this. It goes away and back and forth. There's nothing solid. When I think of the word passive and I think of the word tolerance, I see the same thing anymore. This is something that we as men are struggling with. I think so too. Well, along this line, you've mentioned that our society pushes tolerance. Again, and again, tolerance, it's important to understand that word as it's used today. It means that you cannot know truth. The truth is what you make it to be. And your truth is no more valid than someone else's truth. That's what tolerance means today. When somebody says you're intolerant, they mean you are standing on something firm and you shouldn't be. Because that is interfering with my ability to hold a different view and still be of the same weight. That's what tolerance means. So we are being pushed to being to passivity, where we have nothing to stand on. So let's go on. Let's just put that to the side. What else do you see our society expecting of men? It's maybe a little bit more difficult. But what else? And I think of the television being part of this. What else is being expected of men? We're expected to be men of integrity. There's two things that come to my mind. I'm just curious what else. Do you ever feel that society expects men to be discontent?
Right.
If you are a good man, you are discontent. And that if you are a good man, according to our society standard, you are discontent. And you are demonstrating that discontent by all the nice stuff you got. And you are feeling good about yourself in that, and hoping that the discontent doesn't show itself too much by all the things that you wrap around yourself. That is what our society expects of a man. What about the line, be all you can be? What does that promote?
Right, yeah.
What else is a man expected?
And society confuses happiness with contentment.
Okay.
And pushes for happiness, which is a very fleeting thing. You buy a new car, you're happy for how long? Until you look at your neighbor's car, who just bought the next model up. But contentment is a state of the soul.
Absolutely.
Contentment is a state of the heart. It's the inner, it's where you are inside.
Right.
And we should, contentment is what matters. Happiness is, but the society has gotten it all confused and tries to convince us that we are happy when we buy things.
Right.
And it totally ignores the important aspects of your contentment.
Matter of fact, the three things that I wrote when I thought about this of what does society expect of a man, they see society, again, the sociologist said it, men have a natural tendency to avoid social responsibility. That is how society sees men. But society expects certain things of men, passivity / tolerance, selfishness. Society does not expect a man to die to himself. Society expects man to be selfish. That is, I mean, when you think of our society expects that men to be selfish. And our society expects men to be discontent. I don't know how to watch television or read the magazines or the newspapers or anything and not see these things. And then just question, you know, this brokenness. Our society does not long for us to be broken. It's built on self-centeredness. It really is. And I think that's very confusing to men. But I think that men are doing their level best to fit the model. And it doesn't work. And then they try to fit that model, they come across as totally disinterested with a tendency to avoid social responsibility. But I think there's far more to it than irresponsibility. And I think back to my horse. Thank you for commenting. Keep looking at the clock thinking. We could continue this around the campfire, but let me just keep going for a minute. I go back to my horse, and I mentioned that, you know, my horse is not irresponsible. My horse is looking for something that will stimulate him. And I think that with men, it's far more than irresponsibility. I think they've been emasculated. I do. I think they're wanting to find something that's worth getting excited about. I really do. I think they want to give themselves to something of relevance. And our society continues to take that from them. I think that men want to look back and say that the things that they've invested their lives in matter. But when society pushes passivity and discontent and self-centeredness, it's difficult to find things that matter ultimately in that. I want to read you a story that I think illustrates what so many men struggle with. And this comes out of a book that I'm going to recommend. We actually have a number of them. This is a book written by Robert Lewis. It's called Raising a Modern Day Knight. For all you dads, I would recommend getting this book and working through it with your son, or your sons, if he has. But he tells a story that I just thought, this represents so much of what I see around me. So let me just read this. The summer sun beat down upon the blue Pacific. A lone skiff, ferrying a handful of old men, glided slowly across the surface of the water and made its way toward the beach. Waves lapped against the bow. A gentle breeze, refreshing and seductive, softened the searing afternoon heat. Tom Quinn, 68, was the first to recognize the tranquil beauty of this tropical paradise. I'm in awe. I'm really in awe, he said. I feel like crying. It's so beautiful now. It should have been back then. And under a cloudless sky, the skiff nestled onto the sandy white beach. One by one, the old men stepped gingerly from the boat. Some of them wept. A few stood motionless, surveying the landscape that had become entombed in their collective consciousness. No one spoke. For each of the retired warriors, the tranquility was shattered by memories from the past life. Machine gun fire, the cries of wounded comrades, stifling heat, and the stench of death. For Tom Quinn and his companions, the nightmare had come full circle. After 50 years of soul-searching, they had returned to the scene of one of the bloodiest battles of World War II, the island of Peleliu. Did I pronounce that correctly? Okay. These veterans carried on their bodies the scars of war and nursed in their hearts the wounds of the spirit. They were haunted by the ferocity of the battle and the death of friends, but to a man, the deepest scar, the most painful wound, was the knowledge that they had fought a battle that was completely unnecessary. It wasn't supposed to be that way. Back in 1944, General Douglas MacArthur designed a strategy to reclaim the Philippines and attack Japan. This entailed conquering a succession of islands between Hawaii and the Philippines, building runways, and then dropping bombs on Japanese strongholds. When 9,000 American troops stormed ashore on Peleliu in September 1944, they believed their thrust was crucial to victory in the Pacific. It wasn't. While the Americans slugged it out with 12,000 well-fortified Japanese soldiers, the war passed them by. Other GIs were already landing just south of the Philippines with little resistance. More than 8,500 Americans were killed or wounded in the struggle for Peleliu. In terms of death per square mile, it was the bloodiest battle of World War II, but it was all for nothing. And as NBC Dateline reporter watched, as an NBC Dateline reporter watched Tom Quinn and his comrades tour the battlefield 50 years later, he remarked, "The veterans of Peleliu have a very hard time with the idea that history has judged their sacrifice irrelevant." Isn't that something? I think there's much said there. I think that explains a lot. I think that many men are passive and uninspired because they feel like their best efforts have been irrelevant. Our society pushes things that create irrelevance. And I just want you all to be men who rise above the irrelevance and reach for something different. Many men have made the same judgment on themselves that history made of the men on Peleliu. They've expended themselves, they've laid themselves on the line, and they found the effort ultimately painless or pointless. I think that what you see in Tom Quinn and the men from the 1st Marine Division was a desire to have a cause that was transcendent, that actually mattered over time. And the problem for many is that they're their own transcendent cause. That's what our culture breeds into a man. I appreciate what another sociologist had to say about men. His name is Ernest Becker. And this is what he said. And I think he gets much closer to the issue than does this previous man. I don't think it's irresponsibility that men are struggling with. I think they're looking for something worth their time. This is what Ernie Becker said. "Man will lay down his life for his country, his society, his family." Absolutely. They're not irresponsible. They will do this. They've shown it time and time again. "He will choose to throw himself on a grenade to save his comrades. He is capable of the highest generosity and self-sacrifice, but he has to feel and believe that what he is doing is truly heroic, timeless, and supremely meaningful." And then later he said, "Nothing grates on a man's spirit quite like irrelevance. Nothing destroys a man quicker than feeling like his best efforts and heroic deeds were meaningless." And I just want you to think about those words that Ernest Becker used and consider your own life. Truly heroic, timeless, supremely meaningful. When was the last time you felt like you invested your life in something that met those categories? I think the problem comes when a man looks at his best efforts and his heroic deeds and he sees that ultimately they're self-centered. There's nothing heroic and timeless and meaningful about them. And when a man comes to that conclusion about his efforts, he just quits. And he becomes passive. And he becomes what that other sociologist said. He just looks irresponsible. Listen to the words of these men who sum this up quite well. The first is the Roman Emperor Septimus. He said, "I have been everything, and it is worth nothing." This is a Roman emperor. How about Napoleon to his brother Joseph? "I am tired of glory at 29. It has lost its charm, and there is nothing left for me but complete egotism." Or how about Solomon? In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 4 through 11, we just find some very, very fascinating words written by one of the wisest men that's ever lived. He said, "I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and I had homeborn slaves. I bought male and female slaves and I had homeborn slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me, and all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. And thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity, and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun." When a man says what these said, "It's my work and it's all for me," then he's left with the same kind of emptiness and despair that these three men expressed. And I'm glad to say that there is a solution for that. And who was it that was talking about the song we were singing about brokenness? And finding a cause higher than our own? I think so. There's a woman named Gail Sheehy. I think she gets close to the answer. She wrote a book called Pathfinders. I don't know if any of you have ever read this book, Pathfinders. She lists what she calls the 10 hallmarks of well-being. So what are the 10 hallmarks of well-being? At the top of her list is this statement: "People of high well-being find meaning in an involvement with something beyond themselves." Absolutely. We need to make a shift towards something beyond ourselves, but we need to be careful what it is. Tom Quinn and Napoleon tried to find it in nationalism and war, and they didn't find it. Septimus did not find it in the highest levels of government. And Solomon did not find it in economic perfection. There needs to be something different. And I want you to embrace the solution. And many of you have. Some of you may not have. So I want to affirm those of you who have embraced the solution. And I want to challenge those of you who aren't quite sure to embrace the solution. The solution is found in a will greater than your own. And it's not just any will. It's the will of the one who created this universe and who created you. I told you of three men who did their best to self-actualize and came to the end and said, "This is just meaningless." Now I want you to listen to the words of a man who found his greatest pleasure in the plans and purposes of God, because this is where we want you to find your greatest pleasure, in the plans and purposes of God. This is Solomon's father. He wrote this: "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul." Is your soul weary? The law of the Lord is perfect. It revives the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. Is your heart weary and saddened? The precepts of the Lord give joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure and altogether righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the comb. And by keeping them, as your servant warned, in keeping them, there is great, great reward. You know, what you see expressed in David and in his words is life full of meaning and full of hope and full of purpose. You see an expectation of a future and of great things. And it's the future that we want for you. And it's found in the love of God and His Word. In the love of God and His plans and purposes. We want you to be men who echo the words of Jesus when He said in John 4:34, He said, "My food is to do the will of Him who sent me and to accomplish His work." Let this be your food. Let this be what gives you energy and drives you. So I want to go back to the question that I asked about the differences between a boy and a man and see if there's any changes to the answer or clarifications to the answer. Can you summarize perhaps a little differently the difference between what you see these days between a boy and a man? You know, it's interesting, in this room there's a real quandary that you have. Because for many of the men in this room, you've rejected what society expects of you as a man. I mean, it's exactly, you've done what Brett just expressed. You said, "I won't be passive. I won't be selfish. I won't be discontent. I'll be thankful to the Lord of the responsibilities He's given me, and I'll embrace them. And I will give my life for that purpose. And I'll find great, great pleasure and joy in that." Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Paul wrote these words in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11. He said, "When I was a child, I reasoned like a child." So he can mind just say, "When I was a boy, I reasoned like a boy. But when I became a man, I put childish ways behind me." In our society, we see boys doing what boys ought to be doing, which is exploring and being totally self-consumed in their interests and just learning about life and exploring. They're self-consumed. Good grief. I mean, anyone that's ever raised a boy or been a boy, which is all of us, you know, being self-consumed is what characterized us. We were. Society expects that's never going to change. But Paul wrote that something changed. When he was a child, he acted like one. But when he became a man, he put childish ways behind him. So I just want to ask you, what is it that a man puts behind him that really makes him become a man and become a person that society looks at and says, "Oh, there's not an irresponsible person"? If you could just use one word to describe what Paul, when he says, "I put childish ways behind me," what did he put behind him? Is there one word? Himself. He took himself and he put himself behind. Isn't that a cool picture? There are a lot of young men who have learned this lesson, and there are a lot of old boys who have not. You know, chronology or age is not a real good definer of manhood. I think when a person does what Paul did and puts himself away and looks for a cause higher than his own, he begins to enter into manhood. I want you to just think about this picture. A boy is consumed by his own pleasure, but he has no staying power. There isn't any. He has no convictions as to what is right, true, and good, so he drifts. That's what boys do. If you just look at boys, that's what they do. But a man has made the switch from boyhood to manhood when he becomes consumed by the plans and purposes of God. He lays aside his own plans and purposes and embraces the plans and purposes of God. And he finds that they give life to his body. He's like a man who has consumed with the plans and purposes of God is like my Arabian horse who prances out the gate excited and ready. They stir him to discovery. And they stir him to adventure. And they give meaning to his days. Some of you in this room could just say, yes, that's true. And others aren't quite sure. You know, I realize I'm just kind of speaking to a very broad group. Some just simply would say, well, this is kind of new. Others would say, this is what I've staked my life on. So whether you've come to be encouraged and affirmed or be instructed, I just want you to come away either learning this or remembering this and be encouraged by it, that God's purposes are incredible. When you lay aside your own purposes for His, you find strength and challenge and excitement and adventure and discovery that goes beyond anything that you could ever, ever, ever come up with on your own. He's asking you to embrace challenges that are more strenuous and rewarding than you could ever imagine. You will need His help. And I just encourage you, don't run away from them. Embrace them. Lose the boy and find the man. I think of Oliver. What a funny kid. I jump off a 10-story building. For fun, you know, not to hurt himself. This is his idea of fun. This is what it means to exercise my maleness. You don't have to be a wild man to be a man. You know, I mean, just you see just people trying to rediscover their manhood by just going wild. That's not what's needed. Just embrace what God has called you to and find the thrill in it. Tomorrow, let me just jump ahead real quick. Tomorrow, Joe Sheldon's going to lead off and talk about some of the plans and purposes of God and the thrill that we find in those plans and purposes. But to embrace them requires you to lay yourself aside. You can't embrace the plans and purposes of God until you do what that song says, I die to myself, I'm broken. So I just want to leave you tonight with a couple of thoughts. And the first is this, if you don't know this already, well, just write this down and meditate on it because I want you to never forget it. And that's this, true satisfaction in life is directly proportionate to your obedience to God. True satisfaction in life is directly proportionate to your obedience to God. It just is. God's commands are benefits, not burdens. They are liberating, not restrictive. True satisfaction is directly proportionate. True satisfaction in life is directly proportionate to one's obedience to God. If you don't know that and hold that as just a deep, deep truth, just confess that to these guys around you. I mean, let's use this as an opportunity to express the frustrations and doubts and discouragements and questions. Because there are guys in this room who would just embrace what I just said and say, that is absolutely true. And they know it experientially. True satisfaction in life is directly proportionate to one's obedience to God. There's two other things I said there. God's commands are benefits, not burdens. They are benefits. God didn't give us His plans and purposes and His laws to make life a bummer. They're benefits. I mean, I just, again, think back to what David, King David wrote in Psalm 19. So again, take the night and just reflect on what I've said. Reflect on what's been said in this room. And just ask yourself a couple of questions. I just want you to ask yourself, what cause have I embraced? Have I embraced my own cause? And do I find myself discontent, discouraged, disillusioned, disconnected? Have I embraced the cause of Christ? I mean, do I wake up in the morning anticipating God has something good today for me? Are you a person who would say, as David said, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving my soul? To lay aside childish things, go from being an older boy to being a man, if you haven't done that yet. Determine in your heart that you will find God's commands to be benefits, not burdens, and be liberated from your drifting and your discouraged, disillusioned, and disconnected past. And step into a life that can be more than anything you ever dreamed it could be. You know, there's what you're talking about there is kind of underneath it all, a sense of what's right and what is true and what is good, and people want that. And then what you see expressed out is real expressions of selfishness, etc. That's the end to a very kind of pessimistic book. We're running a little bit behind, so let's close up. I've asked Pastor Phil to close us out.
You know, as we've been reflecting on this whole issue, I feel like the Lord really wants us to acknowledge ultimately